Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hello, hello, hello. Wow, it's Wednesday again. I missed last week. Today's October 10. Last week, I thought I was going away for the week, folks. And I was all packed, ready to go to a big ECT trial in California against Somatics, Inc. There are only two electroshock machine companies in North America, so it's very important what's going on about all of that. And I was really just about ready to go for the whole week, and I had planned to put in Peter Gertson. I'll talk about that a little bit more. And by the way, I do have a wonderful, wonderful guest that you've heard before and is just a very important person in my life, Pinar Miski, a psychiatrist who does a lot of good things that are very helpful to me and to the movement. I'll introduce you again to her in a few minutes. Pinar, I think you made it already, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
Oh, there you are. Oh, you sound clear as a bell, clear as a bell. So, folks, there I am. I'm getting ready to get on the airplane, packed for a week. this was a very, very important case to me, and I actually ended up volunteering that whole week, or thinking I would be. I'd written my reports and gotten all ready to go, and then I got a phone call from somebody who sounded like they were smiling, the attorney I've been working with, that the case had been settled. So I will be telling you more about this case as I learn how much I can tell you. But I want you to know that there are attorneys out there in the world now actively working on very legitimate, meritorious cases concerning ECT, because ECT does a huge amount of damage to people, and the manufacturers are absolutely refusing to recognize that it does any harm at all. So you might just puzzle on that for a minute. Here you're making a machine that sends 800 to 900 milliamps of current through somebody's brain, well above what OSHA says causes nerve damage. And you've got thousands of people over the years talking about how harmed they've been. You've got animal studies, definitive ones in the 50s. You've got a big consensus conference on electroshock therapy, which I was the expert in the 1980s on brain pathology from ECT. You got all this stuff out there, and you're making machines that you don't even put a label on about causing any cognitive problems at all. Interesting, isn't it? Interesting what happens in the world today. These folks have been protected. I routinely have what I think is a very good relationship with the folks at the FDA in terms of Freedom of Information Act, getting information readily and neatly on psychiatric drugs. I couldn't even find where to go to get this information on ECT and what they were reporting from the manufacturers. Couldn't even get a way to find it. How am I going to find out what the manufacturers have been sending in about reports they're getting and seeing in the literature, because they're required to. If they see them in the literature, if they're getting them, send in reports on people with at least memory loss, never mind losing whole portions of their lives. And my latest note, and I did this well before the lawsuit, my latest note from the people who do the the machinery adverse effects at the FDA, the ones who do that kind of stuff instead of the drugs, my last note was from them was I think it was going to take up to a year to find out what the manufacturers had sent in. Well, would you guess? Until they got sued, they weren't sending in anything? That's pretty interesting, isn't it? That is pretty interesting. So anyway, that suit has been settled. I probably won't be able to talk much about it, but I'll talk a lot about ECT. I've been talking about it my whole life. And I'm guessing that this is the beginning. The beginning of what may be very important work in this field by a number of very seriously dedicated attorneys. So again, it's just wonderful to get on the air with all of my wonderful guests. This is always such a good opportunity to talk to all of you. And let me remind you that if you just happen to be picking this up somewhere, you can listen to it live on PRN FM at 4-5 p.m. And we take callers. My audience is my guest. You're my guests out there. You can call in. 888-874-4888. And I guarantee you, you'll get a nice, friendly response from Alex. Or maybe Jesse, who is in charge. And you'll have a chance to really both listen to the show on PRN-FM while you're calling in on 888-874-4888. And I want to take some time to respond a little more than I have to the great emails that I get on the dedicated line that is just for those of you who listen to the show and learn about how to email me. And the line is breganlive@hotmail.com. Isn't that cool? breganlive@hotmail.com. And I really appreciate the folks who stay in touch with me. I wanted to thank Baller Scholar from Canada for sending me the latest on the variations on lobotomy going on in Canada. There was a time in the 1970s and 80s when I'd stopped just about every single lobotomy project in Canada as a part of my worldwide campaign. Now, but these guys keep sneaking back under new guises, and I'm hoping that the Baller Scholar is going to follow up with even more information. We'll be looking into it and talking to you about it. Now, of course, there's Sarah from California. How many of you think you know and are in touch with Sarah from California? Because she's on the show regularly. She's a audience participant who's becoming a guest. And she was involved with giving some, passing on some information to the folks at doing the ECT trial. And that kind of reminded me that it would be a really good thing to talk about it more with you today. That honking, I suppose you can hear it. That's just, was a car horn going off outside my office here in downtown Ithaca, New York. I keep getting questions, of course, for referrals. I just want to say, folks, that the best I can do is refer you to empathictherapy.org, you know, our other website other than bregan.com, and see if somebody's listed themselves there. And if you are a therapist listening to me and you'd like to try to get some clients or patients who are looking for non-drug approaches, that you can write in to me at breganlive@hotmail.com and let me know that you're interested in having your self put up on the website as a potential person to be getting referrals. And we'll do that. We'll do that. One of the things that's been coming up lately that's kind of interesting and terrifying is the drug companies are talking more and more now in their minions about genetic testing to make sure your drugs work. Genetic testing to tweak your drugs. One of my folks asked what's that about on the emails. And I can't remember whether I've talked about this with you before. I just don't remember. it's one of these things where they take something, turn it into something else, and then use the bat of your brain to death. It is true that the liver has enzymes that are genetically controlled, which break down or metabolize and help remove all kinds of neurotoxins from your blood. And the neurotoxins that they help remove from your blood are the psychiatric drugs. All of them are neurotoxins. They're recognized as enemies of the body, and the liver works hard to get rid of them. Well, there's a wide range of variation in the liver's ability to rid the body of various things, including psychiatric drugs. And then when you have drugs and combinations that can further make it hard for the liver, if two drugs are both being eliminated by the same enzyme, that might slow it down. Some enzymes can even enhance the removal of the drug from the liver, and so on. So what they're starting to talk about is we can tweak your drugs by studying your enzymes and make them better. But what do they mean by that? Let me tell you what they should mean. This is what they should mean. They should mean that all the drug companies should have warnings out. Don't take any psychiatric drugs until you've checked your enzymes, because if you're going to get a super dose, it's not going to be good for you. And we can save you a lot of misery and harm, hopefully, or at least reduce it by warning you that a normal dose of one of our drugs might hit you like it's three times harder. They're not going to do that. That's not going to help their business. That's what they should do. They should have done it decades ago. They've known about it. It's in the warning labels that the FDA insists on. Not that it insists on everything or a lot, but it insists on that. No, what they're going to do is use this information to superpower your drugs and really make you sick. Because making you sick is how the drugs work. Psychiatric drugs, literally, just like alcohol or marijuana or nicotine or bath salts, affect your brain by making you sick. And the reasons we want to do that to ourselves are myriad. But one of them certainly is because when our brain is made sicker, we feel less emotional pain. We feel less in touch with our struggles. That's why people drink and smoke dope and smoke cigarettes and, you know, I'm not saying I'm any better than anybody else. You know, I wished so many times in my life to have less emotional pain. Especially when I was younger. Oh my God, when I was younger, I would have been almost given anything to have less emotional suffering. So I understand. But making ourselves sick to ease our pain should not be the goal of massive manufacturers, the federal government, and so on and on. It's making for a very sick society in terms of the children and adults who are taking these drugs as well, the psychiatric drugs, as well as all the other drugs. And I'm sure that one encourages the other. Psych drugs encourage people to take non-psych drugs. Non-psych drugs encourage people to take psych drugs. So, you know, I just want to keep coming back to what goes on in psychiatry, which is they do not try to make their treatments safer, because the safer they are, the less impact they have. If that weren't true, you wouldn't have shock. We wouldn't have the shock machines being made stronger and stronger. Do you know a modern shock machine can deliver 10 times the damaging energy of the ones that were originally used on human beings that caused so much damage in the 40s and the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, because they keep raising it, finally fixing the most easily measured variable for damage, the current, finally fixing the current in the machines at 800 and 900 milliamps when sometimes 80, less than a tenth, will give you a convulsion. It's about damage. Take a breath. The issues come up again about marijuana and Can it cause psychosis? And yes, it can. Especially in adolescents who start heavy smoking, we see people becoming psychotic and then not recovering very well. But even in adults, especially if you're unaccustomed to the drug, it can cause very psychotic experiences that are very similar to acid trips, maybe not quite as fragmented, but very hallucinatory and very paranoid, very dangerous. Golly, there's a lot to cover, and I'm just trying to take a breath and before I go to Pinar and think about what else I might want to cover. I've been out to see Pam Popper, my wonderful nutritionist PhD in Columbus, Ohio, and we have been filming for courses that will be available for you to buy at the November conference. So Pam and I are putting on this conference. It's almost entirely her work. She honors me by letting me co-sponsor it and by promoting my work. Columbus, Ohio, November 9 to 11. You can find all about it on my website. Go a little bit down on the website to the link that's a banner. That's a better link than the one up top. Goes to a better place. I might fix that. But go down the website to the banner that talks about the conference and with Forum Health or Health Forum with Pam Popper. Click on that and you're going to actually get Pam's phone number. And I don't give it out I don't give it out easily. You got to hunt, but I'm going to give it to you who are listening to me. You can actually call Pam or email her and find out about the conference and about the courses you can buy that will be available at the conference and then online. And Pinar and I will talk about the course that she manages live for me that will be out. That's the second run of it. And it's just an amazing, amazing course. Pam's phone number, Pam Popper, 614-841-7700. 614-841-7700. You might even do better with the email. Very easy. PamPopper@msn.com. PamPopper@msn.com. And I've been filming two courses with her. And one of them is the consumer version of psychiatric drug withdrawal, which will be much less in depth and although interactive, will not have a wonderful psychiatrist Pinar Miski talking with you on a regular basis, as she'll be describing for the other course and having me visit and talk with you too. But it's a good course. It's interactive, and it'll be on drug withdrawal for consumers. And it'll be at my request. We're doing this. It's a much less expensive form and much less time-consuming than the but without, you know, a lot of wonderful things like, you know, talking to me live and talking with Pinar live on the videos. And that'll be available. And then really a dream for me, the heart of being helpful, it's going to be a course on how do you help yourself and then help others? How do you help yourself and then help others? I like that. I don't think I put it that way before. How do you help yourself and then help others? And that's a dream for me. It just cuts through all the nonsense about licensing and all this. I mean, folks are supposed to be able to help each other. We've been helping each other forever, forever. So we're going to learn better and better how to help each other. And then if you're a professional, you can use it, whatever legal professional guidelines there are. And if you're not a professional, you can use it in your family life and your personal life and anywhere else you want because we have a right to help one another, to love one another, and to help one another. Don't forget our breaking news. We've got tremendous news about more and more about the failures of antidepressants. And stay in touch for Oh, and of course, always remember our searchable archive you'll find on our onbregan.com, where you can go back and listen to Pinar Miskey's earlier shows. You can come listen to Peter Gerz's shows. And let us really send our best wishes to Peter Gerz as the weight of the pharmaceutical empire comes down upon him in Europe and in Denmark. This wonderful man who has set the standard with his original organization in the Corcoran collaboration, set the standard for helping monitor the quality of science. And boy, they don't want them monitoring anymore. Bless you, Peter Gerz. And we're going to be putting up, you know, Peter was my first award for in the Honored Blog series. I'm going to put up on that blog series his latest descriptions of what's going on there, so you can keep up with what's happening in Europe. And he needs all of our best wishes, and anybody in Europe who's right there to help him in any way you can, you know, pitch in. Please, pitch in. Well, there's a long chat. Gave Pinar some time to relax. Rest. Hi, Pinar.
Hello, Peter.
Pinar spells her name, or somebody else did before Pinar, P-I-N-A-R, and her last name's Miskey, M-I-S-K-I. She's a psychiatrist in Baltimore. She actually works directly in the field, right in the trenches. I don't promote where in the trenches she's fighting. I let her talk about that when she wishes. Pinar is also very much involved in nutrition, and I actually met her after she met Pam at a nutritional conference. And Pinar is a real blessing in my life because she has taken on the task and did it wonderfully last year of being the live and extraordinarily cheery and inspiring face. I'm looking at a picture of her. And she is inspiration and freshness and intelligence and wonderment in itself. And Pinar is, again, going to run our course this year. You'll also meet her at the conference if you get there. Hi, Pinar. You catch us up on anything or tell us a little bit more about the course and what its trajectory. And, folks, this is the big, intensive Peter Bregan course.
Well, so where do I even begin? For those who didn't listen to the first show that I was on, basically I'm a consultation liaison psychiatrist who works in a general medical setting. So in a typical hospital, not a psychiatric hospital, but a typical hospital. And so they call me for people who have various issues, but sadly, a lot of times there are people who are having medication side effects who ended up in the hospital for what they're going through. And so I was at the PCRM's annual nutrition conference in Washington, D.C., the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, where I ran into Pam Popper and mumbled something about being a psychiatrist, and she kind of looked at me funny, said, you know, I've been looking for a psychiatrist, and I'm kind of wondering, you know, what are you going through that you're looking for a psychiatrist here? And she basically clarified, you know, have you heard of Peter Bregan? And I've been, you know, in touch with him, and I really need somebody to teach some of his ideas, and I'd never heard of you before, Peter. So she basically kind of pointed me in the direction of some of your books, and you were nice enough to send me some of your books, and I read them and kind of realized, okay, you know, nothing that you're saying is untrue. And basically volunteered to teach the class for the Wellness Forum with the information that you've, you know, basically collected over, you know, many decades of your career thus far. So in the class that the Wellness Forum offers that I teach, essentially we take the time each week to review all the different major classes of psychiatric medications, and there are several, and kind of outline in detail, you know, kind of where they, what they're meant for, how they act on the body, potential side effects, and we have basically kind of a step-by-step guide on how people in different groups are at risk for the side effects, and essentially how to safely wean individuals off of the medications. I throw in a couple of thought exercises and assignments for people to kind of mull over, and we really try to, you know, cater it to every individual's needs. You know, there are people who signed up last year, which was the first year that we taught the course. There are people who are basically lay people who were just kind of curious. There were people who had been prescribed and still were on these medications, having a tough time coming off. There were people who are in the field of medicine doing various things who were kind of curious about the subject. So the course is geared towards all sorts of individuals with all sorts of different interests and backgrounds. And I, you know, I'm mindful with the thought exercises and assignments that I make to kind of hopefully make it useful to whoever is taking the class. You know, we understand you could go online and read all sorts of information anywhere, but, you know, to really try through conversation, interaction, and the different exercises to kind of figure out how are you going to apply this information to your practice or your situation and hopefully get something out of it that's worthwhile beyond just, you know, reading Peter's books or all that good stuff. So not to mention the benefit of hearing from Peter himself during the course of the class as well. So that's the class in a nutshell. And I do like what Peter said. I will be at the Wellness Forum annual symposium in November. I greatly look forward to doing that because there's going to be just so many wonderful guests, so many really useful, helpful topics. I think they also added on a last-minute workshop with Dr. Lim, who is going to be talking about the blue zones and diets. And I have a lot of patients who ask questions about diet or probably, well, actually need help about diet and not realizing how diet influences their moods. All of this stuff is tied together, bottom line. So I would encourage anybody to try to attend the conference. But, you know, if you're on a limited budget, sign up for the course. It's online. You call in. It's very interactive. You don't have to leave the comforts of your home. It is a once a week, time dedication. But even if you miss a class, you can listen to it, like, you know, in the future. They record every class. So, you know, I'm just throwing that out there. You know, whoever might be on the fence, go for it. And if not my class, Wellness Forum has like a ton of other classes that you would probably get a lot out of. I personally took the they have like a lifestyle, diet and lifestyle class that overviews a variety of medical topics from cancer to diabetes to heart disease, you name it. Amazing lecturers, well worth the price. It taught me several things. So, you know, highly recommend everybody look through the whole catalog and think about signing up because it really gets you thinking about a lot of things that you assume to be true and you realize, yep, definitely not the way I thought it was. Anyway, so that's the gist of the class. Does that answer your question, Peter?
Oh, we're doing great. And I want to remind folks that Pam Popper has very generously, you know, given her phone number for me to share with you about any of the courses in the upcoming conference. Pam is just a master of outreach, and her phone number is 614-841-7700 or email, which is probably the best. Pam Popper at msn.com. It's hard to exaggerate the depth and richness of the major course, How and Why to Stop Taking Psychiatric Drugs, that Pinar Miskey is so deeply involved in. I mean, it runs for months, and it has reading materials. There'll be assignments. You'll be talking with Pinar live. You'll be talking with Pam Popper live. And last year I appeared once, and you're going to be talking more often also with me live. Now that this thing's running so well, I'll just pop in when Pinar thinks it'd be useful in the evening for me to do so. And I think all the hours are in the evening, right, Pinar?
Yes, they're all usually Thursday evenings, I believe. But, you know, even if you have somebody who has a commitment every Thursday night already, then it's okay because, again, you know, things come up in my life and I might not be able to make it one night. But basically what happens is that class is recorded. So even if you can't make it, you listen to it whenever at your convenience with a phone number that Pam provides you. And I try to have virtual office hours. So if anybody has any burning questions about, you know, things that are covered in the classes, you can always email me or whatever. And again, trying to make this as useful and interactive with people as possible, given life happens, you know.
Bernard, you mentioned the Blue Zone or something like that about nutrition and Dr. Lin. What is the Blue Zone?
Oh, he goes over the Mediterranean diet and, you know, because there's, as you know, the world of nutrition, there's tons of contradictory information out there and, you know, who's right. And the Blue Zones are the parts of the world where the longest functionally lived people are. In other words, you know, not only do they live to be 100 years of age, but they're functional at 100 years of age. And it's kind of an intense area of research trying to figure out why are there these pockets of people that seem to age so much better than the average human. And, you know, it seems, and this has been presented at the PCRM conference on multiple occasions, but, and I'm sure it will be discussed in even greater detail at the upcoming symposium, but it's just fascinating how it seems to be such a multifactorial entity. It's not like, okay, you drink wine and you eat, you know, tons of butter in France and then you live forever. No, it's a lot more complicated than that. And it seems like it's a combination of, in a nutshell, eating right with lots of fruits and vegetables, but also exercise, stress management, and social connectivity, social support. And that's kind of where the mental health piece, I think, fits in. You know, those who have psychosocial stressors tend to age far worse than the average person. And getting the mental health piece of this is often overlooked, as are other things like, you know, sleep deprivation and stress levels and stuff that, you know, we deep down know it's bad, but unfortunately with our American lifestyles, we tend not to, you know, really manage very well. So I'm sure it's going to be a fascinating talk, and I don't pretend to know every single thing about it, but everything that has been presented at the PCRM conference made a lot of sense, and I'm sure Dr. Lim will have his take on it. And it's wonderful to hear. I mean, nutrition in general is a very complicated thing. You know, like, it's very difficult to study. And I can point people to Dr. Campbell's book, Whole, W-H-O-L-E, and he kind of outlines why, as a lifelong nutrition researcher, it's been so challenging to pin down why certain things happen. But through tons of epidemiologic research, it's kind of clear that people who tend to do better are on plant-based diets for the large part, and, you know, all the other things that the people in the Blue Zones do with stress management and all that good stuff. So I could go on and on and on forever, but not enough time in an hour for all this.
I break it down pretty simply, folks. Good relationships, good food, and a little exercise. Put that on your wall. Good food.
That's pretty much it.
Good relationships. And moderate exercise.
Yep, absolutely.
Very, very, very much so. There's so much spinning around in my head, folks. I want you to know I'm writing what I think is my most beautiful book. And doing just, have written and published a book in a few years, been doing so many other things, particularly all that engaging legal work. And I'm just, there's just a life is good. Life is a wonderful thing to engage in, and just bring it out in yourself, and you'll just see your life, you know, getting better and better. One of the biggest lessons I've gotten in the last couple of years from going to Pam's conferences, from talking to Pam, and then Pinar mentioned the Campbell's book, Whole. There's the Campbell, the father, and Campbell, the son. And the father's a PhD in the chemical area, and his son became an MD. And they've both written books you can find online, along with Pam Popper's books, that talk about good food and good eating. And one of the things that I learned beyond the importance of diet was that people who are standing up for eating properly are come under very similar attacks to what myself and now Peter Goetze in Europe is going through. And I was just stunned by that. And, you know, probably the heaviest attack they mounted against me was going after my license in 1980s, for making remarks critical of psychiatric drugs on Oprah Winfrey. And Oprah was actually a fan of mine. She had me on a number of times, and they really went to bat for me and had me back on their show after the attack. And the victory that I got was so overwhelming, the apology so pointed from the state of Maryland and so on, that it was from that I was able to get Toxic Psychiatry published. But think about the fact that even after that, the food industry, the meat people, sued Oprah. They went after Oprah. That's how brazen they were for criticizing hamburgers, basically, on her show. And, of course, she again had a victory. But that today, right now, thought about it before, reminds me of the parallel between these hazards. And Campbell, the elder Campbell, is certainly taken the brunt of all kinds of attack. And he was much more of an inside person already when he started to be critical. And so they couldn't necessarily budge him. And so the battle took place inside. And it's quite interesting as to what the similarities are. The bad eating that's encouraged everywhere by the government, TV, and schools. And the same thing with this bad psychiatry that's encouraged in all the same places, all comes out of huge corporate greed, working with the big government. And it is a very, very similar phenomena. And that's been quite striking to me, and I really didn't appreciate until the last few years working with Pam. We have a caller who's been very patient. And we are taking callers, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. Kind of an odd number, full of interesting swirls around eights and fours. Thomas, is Thomas still online with us patiently? Is Thomas there?
Yes, I'm here.
You're there.
Yes, I hear you, Dr. Bregan.
Okay. Well, hi. You had emailed me on Bregan Live.
Yes.
Thank you for calling. What would you like to talk about?
Well, yes, I emailed, I think it was a few months back originally, and that was regarding the pharmacological genetic testing and my experience with it and what I had seen in terms of the use of it, that they made it something that seemed very practical and useful for people that are taking psychotropic drugs. But in reality, it's, as we know, all the psychotropics are neurotoxic, and I went into it with that understanding, but I was feeling for myself like, well, maybe I could use it outside of that, because I think there is some usefulness in what they call an adverse drug reaction, where people are on multiple medications that, excuse me, may not just be psychotropics, but as you take more and more medications, you're liable to have more possibility of a bad interaction.
That's well put. That's very, very important, folks. More and more drugs you take, including non-psychoactive drugs, if they're hitting those same enzymes in the liver, you have the risks of getting effects you didn't expect. The medicine you need may not be staying in your blood long enough, and the medicines that are poisoning you may stay longer than you want, and then you get drug interactions directly between them. That's separate from the liver. They may be overstimulating serotonin in combinations and things like that. So, yes, I think it's important practical information. I'd like to see its main use be to throw caution to people who are prescribing all these drugs. Go ahead, Thomas.
Yes. So it was pretty much like you said in the beginning of the show, how they've taken this and kind of twisted it around and are using it now to supercharge their prescription of the psychotropics, because even my prescriber, when I was bringing information, and I've been following you and the Mad in America blogs, and they had quite a bit of useful information regarding the pharmacogenetic testing to kind of decipher it, because it is a little bit complicated. And so I kind of did a little bit of that research, but my provider really didn't have any understanding of that. And so they were kind of taking it at face value, the company that came into the office and offered this service, which I found out later from my provider. They were pretty open with telling me how this came about, that the company just pretty much came in and they were like, oh, okay, sure, you know, we'll participate. And I don't know if they really did a lot of background checking, but unfortunately the company that's doing it, well, they know it's a psychiatric facility, you know, outpatient facility, and so their target is the psychotropics. But worse than that, the report that they actually deliver to you, which does have some of the useful information at the very end involving the enzymes, and which are normal, and you know, normal metabolizers and maybe less metabolizers, depending on, you know, the person. But in the beginning, it's all by the drug name of all the different psychotropics. And it's basically on an individual basis, that if you're on, you know, a certain antidepressant, then, oh, well, you're not metabolizing it that effectively. We better boost your dose, you know. That kind of thing. And even my provider was reading it that way. And I said, whoa, wait a second, you have to look at the interactions here, because some of the drugs block other enzymes, and then the result is not a less effect, it's a supercharged effect, as you were saying.
I want in a minute to ask Bernardo to chime in on this, but I'm really involved here. I'm thinking, folks must be thinking to themselves, how can psychiatrists be so stupid? That's what I'm sitting here thinking. How can psychiatrists be so stupid? And the answer is that it's the only way to be a psychiatrist nowadays. When you're seeing six people an hour and drugging them, literally six people an hour, you don't know them from Adam. And you may not even know who Adam was. And you're just drugging them. You have to enforce stupidity and lack of empathy on yourself to live in this manner. And to be attracted into it, you have to have some sort of absent molecule here or there. What a bad metaphor that was. Pinar, you have any thoughts on all this?
Well, I know it's come up with... interestingly enough, I have used the genetic testing for patients that I suspected of having side effects of drugs, who were in various environments, like, you know, psych hospitals and stuff like that, who came in with side effects that were suspected to be related to drugs. One case of serotonin syndrome. And the testing takes so long to come back that it's generally not very helpful for people who are in the hospital right then and there. But I think, if anything, you know, as the caller astutely noted, you know, you would make the argument that for certain people, it might be protective, because, hey, I'm a slow metabolizer and I don't want too much medication, period, because I get side effects very easily. But unfortunately, if you end up being labeled as somebody who rapidly metabolizes drugs, yeah, doctors can come back at you and say, oh, then we need to really crank it up. But, you know, the problem is that it's not just the liver enzymes. The liver enzymes are just one piece of it. Even what you eat influences how you metabolize things, in the case of, you know, anticoagulants, blood thinners, that kind of stuff. Just, you know, I'm sure how much exercise you get, how much sleep you get, how much, you know, how much stress you're under, all these things probably ultimately affect your drug levels in some unknown way at this point in time. And saying that you can reduce everything just to one test is silly. And I think it's a fairly expensive test. I don't recall off the top of my head what it costs.
It can be expensive, and that's because the drug companies have not wanted people doing them. This whole new fad is kind of a tweaky and twitchy thing that I'm not sure where it's going. But these tests wouldn't have to be expensive if they were being done on tens of millions of people. And if the drug companies said, don't take one of our drugs without getting tested first, then this could be, I'm sure, not expensive at all. But so many people would not take their drugs when they learn what the implications were for them in particular. But yes, it's pretty expensive and slow now, but it would not have to be that way at all.
True. But in the end, I mean, do you really need the test to let, you know, people know when they're having side effects and feeling bad? So,
Well, that's a very good point. Yeah, why do we have, if doctors really talk to their patients during the visits, they would be monitoring the adverse effects themselves. But they don't. Yeah. And often, in the legal cases I'm in, the docs are turning down the information they're getting from family calling in and saying, you know, Joe's tripping, Joe's falling down, Joe can't find his way around. And the doc, next time in, maybe if he pays any attention at all, and that doesn't just get mad for the family interfering, so he'll add a stimulant to try to counteract the sedative effect of the drugs. It's that sick what goes on in the profession now. Pinar, it might be interesting you to talk about something you mentioned. You mentioned serotonin syndrome. One of the things that helps, I think, people to understand that these drugs are all neurotoxins is they all have their characteristic extreme neurotoxic reaction, which is nothing more than the extreme endpoint of the drug's basic effect. And often these effects can occur early in treatment, sometimes later. Often they can occur with relatively small doses for all of the complex reasons that I'm so glad Pinar is mentioning, you know, to show that we can't really predict adverse drug reactions, and you can get the worst possible drug reactions on small doses of these drugs. And in serotonin syndrome, which is related in some way to overstimulation of serotonin, a person's reflexes are jacked up, and you're jumpy, you're agitated at the start of it. Eventually, your reflexes may be putting you into muscle spasms. The doctor taps your knee, and you may just go into, near convulsions without loss of consciousness, with your twitching from being overstimulated. And you may get a fever, you may get delirious, and along the way you'll be angry and irritable and difficult. Well, you know, this relates to all of the adverse reactions along the continuum, because one of the most important and dangerous things we get with serotonin-stimulating drugs, which in itself, by the way, is much more complicated than that, but along the way you get irritability and anger, and many, many episodes of severe violence are connected to these drugs. I write extensively about that. Medication Madness, which I think is one of my most interesting books, where I talk about medication madness. And then you look at the antipsychotic drugs, you know, Geodon and Zyprexa and Risperdal and Seroquel, and they have a characteristic reaction called neuroleptic malignant syndrome, which looks very similar to serotonin syndrome, except the endpoint isn't so much hyperactivity as you get rigid, your muscles get tied down, you start having all kinds of adverse neurological effects, but you end up impaired in your brain function, maybe with a fever. You look like somebody who has literally a viral encephalitis, and that is the endpoint. Well, what do you get along the way? You get the buildup toward apathy and indifference, which is the ultimate emotional characteristic of these drugs. You get the neurological deficits along the way. And even the stimulants we give our kids, it says in the FDA full prescribing information for the stimulants that extreme reactions are known to occur on small doses and routine doses. And what do you get there? You get overstimulation again, including serotonergic and including dopaminergic and other transmitters, and it's a very mixed picture, but you can get just, you know, terribly overstimulated and psychotic with risks to your cardiovascular system. And these are neurotoxins with typical patterns of increasing doses, but irregularly so, because it's unpredictable, but increasing doses causing their own unique, somewhat unique, massive neurotoxic responses. If you look at the sedatives we take, you know, what's the ultimate neurotoxic response of taking benzodiazepines or Ambien or Sonata, you know, to sedate yourself? Well, it's complete anesthesia, coma, and then cardiovascular collapse. It's extreme anesthesia is the end point. So just to throwing that out for you, and Pinar, you really are into science a lot too, and you got any embellishments on all of that?
No, I think that's pretty much the gist of it. I mean, you know, the risks are multiple in every single, I mean, even within a class of a medication, there are certain side effects or, you know, hazards for each individual medication within a class in many cases. And yeah, it's tricky. And another thing I think for the audience to keep in mind is that sometimes, unfortunately, it can be kind of hard to figure out, is it the drug? Is it me? Is it something else? People can and do develop medical issues along the way that could be mixed up in all of this. Unfortunately, psychiatrists in general kind of want, you know, when you're a carpenter, you think of everything as a nail that you need to hammer, right? And so when a person comes into an office saying that they've been feeling weird, automatically the assumption is, okay, maybe it's the anxiety or whatever coming back, and then they increase the medication dose. And that's when you can really run into problems if it is something related to your medication. So keep that in mind, not just for psych meds, but for any medication. You know, the higher the dose, generally, the more dangerous it can be. So that's something that the audience has to be aware of. Advocate for yourself, because sometimes your doctors will miss these things and, in fact, accidentally make things worse.
And sometimes intentionally make things worse because, I mean, in the legal cases I see, the high doses are used to cover up the adverse effects, getting the person so numb and suppressed that they don't realize they're developing the abnormal movements of tardive dyskinesia that you get from any one of the commonly used antipsychotic drugs. And even to some extent, you can get things like it from the stimulants and the antidepressants. And sometimes they'll just raise the doses because they initially mask the symptoms as they're developing. So we're in a pretty dreadful situation right now. And then medication spellbinding sets in. I mean, this amazing phenomenon whereby we don't recognize, hardly any of us recognize, the impairments we're getting from psychoactive substances. And people who smoke dope don't realize they're getting so blunted and their memory is beginning to get worse and that they're just pretty much not doing a lot of new and exciting things in their lives. And people who drink alcohol at night don't realize maybe how much it's impairing their relationships with their kids or their family. Even smoking, you know, people are really inhibited in knowing their feelings when they're smoking. When they stop smoking, one of the things that withdrawal entails is an awful lot of new emotions, some they haven't had since teenagers when they started. So the drugs suppress emotions. That's what they do. And in long term, they create really indifference and apathy. And along the way, the doctors think the patients are doing as well as they can when they're doing worse and worse. And it's usually the family who looks at the situation and says, this isn't working out very well. But then again, they may try to stop the medication or encourage patients to stop, and the patient ends up in withdrawal and in the hospital. Family has no idea what's going on, no idea. So they begin to think, oh, my God, we have to keep our 24-year-old on these drugs for the rest of his life, living at home with us so we can take care of him. It's a dreadful situation people get trapped into from lack of knowledge of the kinds of information that Pinar and I are sharing with you. today. The Panara, you know, enter in here and join me. You're not used to being on the radio. Is this your second show ever on the radio, Panara?
It's the second show ever
on the radio. So you're doing good. And your little bit of shyness gives me the opportunity to talk a lot too. And I like
to
do
that.
Well,
I'm being selfish. I'm trying to absorb as much wisdom as I can. So I tend to want to keep my mouth shut and listen to every minute.
That may be why we don't get so many callers today as we usually do, because we're sharing a lot of thoughts today and a lot of wisdom, and I think people like that. And as a result, they don't necessarily, call in as much. And folks, I want to tell you that the legal work, too, I wanted to catch up on that, and not just electroshock treatment. But the same week that we had the settlement in the electroshock case, I had a big settlement in a tardive dyskinesia case, which is these awful movements. I mentioned them earlier, that people get on this wide variety of drugs that get called antipsychotic drugs when people are being more honest. But a lot of them, like Abilify and Seroquel, they'll be given to you as a sleeping pill, or they'll be given to you under the guise of being a mood stabilizer, or the guise of being an antidepressant. And people are getting tired of dyskinesia without ever knowing that the drug they're on is capable of causing that and was developed for suppressing people diagnosed with schizophrenia or a manic episode. They just don't know that. And since the doctors often don't mention even the word tardive dyskinesia if they're giving any kind of adverse effects to the patient, they should give a really extensive list, but they may say, I might get something wrong, a movement disorder or something like that in passing. But since they haven't heard the word tardive dyskinesia, they're not thinking, hey, there's something big there. I better look that up and learn more about it. So you could be on any one of these drugs and not know what class of drug you're even on. So get the real name of the drug, get the generic name of the drug or the real trade name, and look it up if you're taking any kind of drug. And, of course, psychiatric drug. Look it up. Google it. You'll get more information, contrary to what my colleagues think, you'll get more information or general conversations on Google about adverse drug effects than you might get from clinical, than you will get from clinical trials, which last 6 weeks or 4 weeks. And of course, you got to find your way through the information, and that's what folks have to deal with now. We're getting near the end. Hey, Panar Miski, thank you so much for being on. My dear, wonderful audience, thank you for giving me a chance to have a voice in this world directly to you. Keep in touch with me. Keep writing to me at breganlive@hotmail.com. And I will see you next week, Wednesday, 4 p.m. New York time. Bye-bye.
Take care.